You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, January 22nd, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
And we have a special guest rogue this week, Brian Dunning.
Hey, hey.
Welcome back, Brian.
Thank you very much. Great to be here. I am Bob and Jay, rolled into
That's
one
That's right. Bob and Jay are on special assignment this week. I'll just leave it at that. They are traveling, so they cannot join us for the show today, unfortunately. Brian will, I'm sure, fill their shoes nicely. But we do have Rebecca, who's going to start us off, as she always does, with the disdain skepticism.
I will. Okay, so the thing I'm going to tell you about did not apparently happen on January 26th, the date that the show goes out. But I read originally that it had occurred on the 26th, and after I spent like an hour researching, I confirmed that it actually happened on January 29th. But I'm going to tell you about it anyway because it's awesome. It all started in June of 1696 when the mathematician Jean Bernoulli came up with a problem known as the brachistochrome curve. So imagine two points, A and B. They're almost horizontal, but A is a little bit higher than B. Now imagine a ball that will roll along a line from A to B. Here's the problem. What is the curve of that line between those two points that would get the ball from A to B the fastest, assuming that it had no speed at the start and was only traveling via the strength of gravity and assuming no friction? The end result basically looks like a crooked happy face, but that's not the solution Bernoulli was looking for, obviously.
That wasn't the answer, crooked happy face?
Crooked happy face was not the answer, no. He published his problem in Acta Eruditorum, a German science journal. He gave the mathematicians 6 months to solve it, and nobody did. And this was a pretty popular journal. It was the first one in the German area at the time, so it was a pretty big deal. Gottfried Leibniz, the editor of the journal, wrote Bernoulli a letter asking for more time after the 6 months were up. So Bernoulli agreed to extend the deadline by another year. Now, Isaac Newton was not a subscriber to that particular journal. And in fact, he and Leibniz apparently hated each other because Newton thought Leibniz cribbed his calculus notes and passed them off as his own. So since Newton hadn't seen the problem and nobody else had solved it, Bernoulli mailed it to him. It arrived on January 29th, 1697. Newton got home from his job at the Royal Mint at 4 p.m. He got the problem, sat down, and worked on it for 12 hours straight, and then sent the solution to the Royal Society to be published anonymously. So a problem that Europe's finest mathematicians could not solve in 6 months, Newton solved in 12 hours. Now, despite the anonymity, everybody knew who had made them all look like chumps. Bernoulli famously said, "Tanquam exunque leonem," or "we recognize the lion by his claw," thus marking the first and last time a mathematician has been compared favorably to a predatory animal.
But that quote, though, is not confirmed, I read. That's just suspected.
It's a good quote.
It sounds good, yeah.
Yeah, of course. It's too good, right? It's too good.
It's almost too good.
What's funny is during this time, they were smack-talking each other. But like they were smack talking each other in 17th century British politeness, you know.
Thouist is an idiot.
No, not even like Bernoulli wrote, "So few have appeared to solve our extraordinary problem, even among those who boast that through special methods they have not only penetrated the deepest secrets of geometry, but also extended its boundaries in marvelous fashion," et cetera, et cetera. And then he specifically called out Newton. And he sent Newton a copy. I mean, he was like, that's why Newton did it I think dedicated himself to doing it because he realized that his honor was being directly challenged.
Oh, yeah.
By
definitely.
Bernoulli. Yeah.
Can I ask about the problem again? Is this like a zip line where the weight of the ball causes the string to sag as it moves?
No.
Or is this, so the string is like it's fixed. It's like a solid ramp.
Yes.
It's like a solid curve.
I see. So we're talking about the curve at which a string would normally hang just by its own mass. But then it's fixed firm in its position. So the ball will roll along it without making it sag.
Yeah. Or just imagine a valley.
I'm asking because I'm going to solve it myself in the next few hours.
Right.
Well, it's not necessarily. So it wouldn't necessarily be the shape of that a string would naturally take if it was sagging by gravity. It's whatever mathematical curve creates the line of quickest descent, as they called it. And the answer has actually a specific shape. It's an upside down cycloid. Happens to be
cycloid.
The curve that gives you that result. They proved it independently. Then they realized, hey, that's an upside down cycloid. That's the answer. Yeah.
And a cycloid, if you imagine like a bicycle wheel and you draw a dot somewhere along the wheel and then roll the bicycle, every time that dot touches the, you follow the path of that dot, like touching
one point
the ground
on the outer
and then
edge
go
of the,
in,
on
up
the
into
edge
an
of the
arc.
Circle. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a cycloid.
Stretched out slinky.
We have to mention that Leibniz was also among those to submit a correct answer. There's the famous Leibniz Newton who had priority for the calculus, you know.
Yeah, Leibniz eventually did turn in an answer that got published along with two other people.
Bernoulli's brother was one.
Who then created a harder problem just to one up his brother. What is up with the Bernoullis? They were like the Olsen twins of their day. There are three of them, though, I think. I can't think of siblings.
They were the novellas of their day.
Good one.
Not quite.
Yeah, very appropriate. are we Leibniz people here or Newton?
Newton. Are you kidding? Leibniz was a sucker. Do you see how Newton owned him? It took him 12 hours to do that.
His first name is Gottfried. Everyone called him Gilbert.
Gilbert. All right. So we're just going to do a hit and run on the Leibniz-Newton debate and move on.
Poor Leibniz.
Suck it, Leibniz.
He's not even around to defend himself. Poor guy.
There's a little bit of a theme to the few news items we're going to cover this week. We have actually two very interesting interviews coming up later in the show. We're going to do a few news items. See if you could pick up on the theme that just happened to be running through these items. We're going to start with, Evan, you're going to tell us about the Manti Te'o hoax.
Yeah, Manti Te'o. You may have heard the name being bantered about the media this past week. Manti Te'o, was a star football player for Notre Dame, the Fighting Irish. That's American football, by the way, not soccer. Notre Dame has a very storied history in college football. They're considered one of the giant sports programs in the country. It's big time. Manti had a tremendous year this year, and he finished second in the voting for the Heisman Trophy, which essentially makes that player the player of the year in the entire country. And he's expected to be one of the top recruits in the National Football League. He has all the makings of this National Football League superstar. Now, during this past season, while Te'o was in the process of accumulating this great season, he was playing under the pain of very personal loss. Both his grandmother died and his girlfriend, a young woman by the name of Lune Kukuo, she also died. And Manti had been informed that his grandmother and his girlfriend died within 6 hours of each other. So Te'o used that emotion to spark his team to a big upset victory that following Saturday. And his story, which not only captivated his teammates and his coaches and the entire university, it eventually became a big national story, a story of triumph over this insufferable emotional pain. And his story sort of helped push Notre Dame to the national title game. It sort of just kept growing and growing. Now, they did eventually lose the title game, but nonetheless, it was a story that anyone with a heart could really appreciate. And in a way, this is almost like a storybook or the stuff that movie scripts are made out of. Well, as it turns out, just last week, it was revealed that Te'o's girlfriend never existed in the first place.
Right.
Yeah. Te'o says he's the victim of a very elaborate hoax and that he's really embarrassed beyond belief that he has fallen for it. But really not everyone is buying that. And there are a lot of reasons to believe that Te'o.
How would he not be?
Te'o is complicit in this. Yeah. How could he not be? I mean, he spoke on camera directly about having conversations with this person, meeting her over the course of years. Yet really she never actually existed. But how did it get to the point where the story sort of took on a life of its own and became had this national following to it, you know, not only for Te'o, but also about, you know, the woman he loved and really having to play through this pain and all of this. Let me put it to you this way. Only a handful of reporters and bloggers truly understood what the bigger and more important aspect of this story was, and that is the media absolutely failed to do its diligence in uncovering the facts behind this story, and through their compliance and what I think they're wanting for this story to have been true, because it is such a great story in itself, the media absolutely collectively failed us all in performing their most basic functions.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the real story here is that it exposes this massive failure on the part of mainstream media journalism to do basic fact-checking. It's just that the culture of reporting has degraded, in my opinion. There were multiple holes in this story. There was no death certificate for this girl. She was never at the university where she allegedly was attending. Any attempt to get a second source to verify any of the details of this story would have exposed the whole thing. And multiple reporters just told the story at face value without confirming anything. And I think they're just going to gloss over this and keep on going the way they are, you know, not really have the soul-searching lesson that it should be teaching them.
Yeah. We have to credit the folks at the sports website Deadspin.com and authors Timothy Burke and Jack Dickey. They are the ones who were the first ones to really look into the facts behind the claims here, and the ones who revealed to the world that this was made up, that this woman, his girlfriend, never actually existed. To put it in their own words, and I quote, "As Teo's celebrity swelled, so did the pile of inspirational stories about his triumph over loss. Each ensuing story seemed to add yet another wrinkle to the narrative, and details ran athwart one another." Right? So there was a lot of problems with the stories. Nobody decided really to put either a timeline together, or like you said, Steve, even just check the basic facts. Okay, who was this woman? You know, why is there no death certificate? Did she really attend the school? And we're talking major media here. You know, ESPN, Sports Illustrated Magazine, New York Times, Fox Sports, New York Post. One article said that there were no less than 21 major media outlets that ran the story or stories about it during the course of the year, and none of them ever dared to find out which parts of the story were true and which ones were fiction.
Yeah, let's be clear. This wasn't an anomaly. This wasn't one that just snuck past the goalpost. This was a systemic failure, right? I don't think I'm overstating it, of this.
No, and your use of the goalpost terminology was perfect, Steve. Spot on.
I'm not sure that I would say – I think this one was probably unique in just how many hands it slipped through. But I think most stories are going to slip through some – slipping through fingers or slipping through goalposts, whatever we're doing.
Both.
In what I do, I'm sitting here spending a full week immersed in a story, and I go through – I follow up hundreds of little leads. But it's impossible to verify everything. And especially if you're going on, if using as one of your sources somebody who you trust. For example, if I find something on Scientific American, for time constraints, I usually don't bother to double check it. That's good enough for me.
If you're doing a whole feature on one person and a huge part of that feature is their dying girlfriend, surely you would look into it.
Well, if she's dead, I mean, what are you going to do? We can't call her up. I mean, it's not something that there's an immediately convenient way to verify.
Sure. Get the death certificate.
And you could call her up because this was going on while she was supposedly still alive.
She allegedly was in a car accident months earlier. That's how the leukemia was discovered that eventually killed this fictitious girl.
Right.
There would have been a police report. Right. There would have been a police report. That police report didn't exist. He met her at a university she never attended. So I agree with you, Brian, in that, you know, the lines of journalism have been blurred. And I think about, like, I write a daily blog pretty much, you know, and the number of news stories I cover a week. Again, you were at the other end of the spectrum. You put a whole week into one story. I write about a dozen stories over the course of a week. Right. And this is my hobby. I mean, this is my part-time, you know, vocation. This is not my full-time job. So I rely upon journalists most of the time to do their job about basic facts. You know, I investigate the literature, you know, the science, but I can't be, I'm not going to, I don't have time to do basic basic legwork journalism of getting two sources for every important fact for a story. I'm assuming the journalists are doing that, or even if I don't assume that, all I could do is really say, well, if the reports are true, you know, this is what they're saying. But a full-time journalist where that's their job, this is what they're supposed to be doing with their time, is verifying basic facts, getting two sources on anything that's interesting or important. And they're not doing that. They're just taking stories at face value. That it's that level of reporting where the failure is happening here. And just, you know, 99 times out of 100, it doesn't come to light, or, you know, people are basically telling the truth, or, you know, and, but we've talked about the fact, whenever you actually know the nitty-gritty details of a story, the news media report it completely wrong. Well, that's because they're reporting every story wrong. Just that you only know about it when it's something where you independently know what the details are. This is just, you know, a dramatic episode exposing the fact that they're not doing their job.
Yeah, you can almost forgive a reporter for actually doing the legwork, and although they may report it wrong, incorrectly, may not get all the nuances down and so forth, you know, they've at least done some legwork and have strived to make some effort to be correct here. But I don't know. They have just been derelict in their most basic of duties.
And these are their own standards. I'm not making things up. And this is like if you journalistic standards, you know, the cliche is if your mother tells you that she loves you, get a second source on it. That's the hard-nosed journalist cliche about how they're supposed to question everything. Clearly, they weren't doing that here. It's their own standards that they're not living up to. Mm-hmm. So it's a sad story, too. You know, we could speculate endlessly about what happened here. I think this is a hoax that got away from these guys. You know, this, because I think it started before Tao was a national figure.
Yeah, 2009. This dates back to 2009 when they put the timeline together.
And then it got out of control. He became famous. Suddenly, they're getting national media attention, and there's hoaxes going on. So they tried to shut it down by killing her off. I mean, I think that's what happened.
You know, that's the interesting part of the story too, is kind of the post-failure analysis. Like, dig out it forensically and see what the whole genesis of this was. Because it's very interesting that it started before he was famous and before it made any obvious sense to create such a hoax story.
Right.
In addition to the fact that this was just a plain case of reporters not doing their job, I do think stardom plays into this, and particularly with sports stars. This is not the only story in the past couple of weeks to pop up of a professional athlete, or, well, he's not a professional athlete, but he probably will be, a famous athlete who got away with something completely ridiculous under the nose of tons of journalists who should have been asking questions. Of course, I'm talking about Lance Armstrong. You know, there were a few reporters like the Sunday Times crew that have been after him for years and years and years and have been bullied by him and by other reporters who just wanted to believe Lance Armstrong and weren't asking the tough questions and were just letting it go. But at least it's good to see reporters like that who actually did their job, the guys with the Sunday Times, getting their day. But
yeah,
there's so many others that just aren't doing their job. And I think because they buy into this idea of celebrity, because they, you know, they want to believe the story that the celebrity is selling. And I think that that's a big one with this football player as well.
Just one last indictment of the media regarding this story, Steve, if I may. There was an article today in Boston.com from a page called The Gatekeeper, and his name is Mark Lissess. And here's what he had to say about this, because I found this really interesting. The day after Deadspin broke the hoax story, the bosses at Sports Illustrated asked one of their reporters, his name is Pete Thamel, who did the October 1st cover story for Sports Illustrated, which involved Tao. And they asked him to give an account of his reporting, which he did, and included a transcript of his interviews with Tao. And Thamel, this reporter for Sports Illustrated, described checking the story after his interviews in the Notre Dame campus, and he found that there were some red flags when he went back and checked. He solved the red flag problem by making changes to his copy, right? So, in a sense, you know, he sort of
cheated.
Maybe realized at that point, right, that, oh, geez, I guess I didn't, you know, do what I was supposed to do here. Later, let me change a few things.
Yeah,
now.
He fixed the anomalies instead of following up on them as if they were meaningful.
And he essentially ignored some solid pieces of evidence that were there that clearly stated that the Sgalkekua did not exist.
Well, let's move on. Very different kind of story. Have you guys seen the pictures of the river on Mars?
Beautiful pictures.
Yeah.
I have heard all about this and had not seen a single picture.
Scientists uncover massive river on Mars, declares the articles. This is in slash gear.
Yeah.
So the European Space Agency discovered a 1,500-kilometer river in the upper Ruvalis region of Mars. And there are some very stunning 3D images of this area. You could see the craters. That's how you know it's like not the Earth, because like way more craters than you would have on the Earth. A little mountain range. There's this massive river snaking along as rivers do, with tributaries coming off of it and, you know, tributaries of those tributaries. It's clearly a riverbed. It's clearly an ancient dry riverbed on the surface of Mars. It's estimated that this is between 1.8 and 3.5 million years old. Very stunning evidence that there definitely was liquid water on the surface of Mars in the past. And, you know, 2 or so million years ago.
Not that long ago,
if you know, considering the 4 billion year history of the solar system. Very interesting. But what caught my eye too is that, is the title of the article, Massive River on Mars. It's actually a riverbed, not a river. And the picture that accompanies the article has false color in order to signify the altitude. And the riverbed is a nice sea blue.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks
very convenient.
How could that possibly be misinterpreted?
Yeah, how could that possibly have a massive river and there's a picture of what looks like a river, you know, with water flowing through it? I mean, really? How many people are going to see that and think there's flowing water on the surface of Mars today?
Plenty. Although, you know, Steve, when I saw it, I did not think that. That did not jump to my mind first.
Only after the fact,
I was like, oh, yeah, look what they did here. Yeah, how very convenient.
Yeah, of course, you're not going to – if you're familiar with this whole issue of the question of water on Mars, obviously you're going to know instantly what this is. And then you could tell that it's a false color image if you're used to looking at those things. But – yeah, I mean, you know, this is designed to misinform, to give the false impression. You know, the title and the picture combined, at first glance, anyone who's not already pretty savvy to this sort of thing is going to think there's a friggin' river on the surface of Mars. It's ridiculous.
I have a question.
Yeah.
There's a boat.
We've had good pictures of the surface of Mars for a long time. In fact, it's been several years, I think, since we've been able to use Google Earth in Google Mars mode. Why has nobody seen this before? How could we have such a cosmic discovery at this late date?
This has been seen before. I think this is just better quality images. It's 3D images, and it's processed in such a way that the river and the tributaries really pop, you know? So I think it's just a really good picture of it. But it's not like this is news that there are riverbeds on the surface of Mars. That this has been known for a while.
So the news is just, this is when someone decided to paint in the blue.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah, sort of, yeah.
No, it's you know, it's the pictures keep getting better and, you know, our technology keeps getting better and it really is a gorgeous picture.
What's the consensus here? Is this just poor science communication or is this deliberate screw up?
I don't know.
It's a good question.
I don't know for this particular outlet or the outlets that were doing this if the headline writer is not the person who wrote the article, but it's not really made, I mean, plain in the article either. So the person who wrote the article was probably didn't know what the headline was going to be. Got to read deep down into the article. Yeah, it all becomes clear, but nobody, if either they didn't consider the impact of the headline and that picture, or it was deliberate just to get people to read it.
I mean, what about the picture itself though, from NASA's standpoint? I mean, you're working in PR. Is that the photo you give to the newspapers? Because there's also a beautiful photo that's brown. It's all shades of brown.
Yeah.
Do you not realize? Does NASA not sit back and think, oh, well, this is going to be misinterpreted? Because regardless of the headline, when people see that, they'll be like, oh my God, it's a river.
I think it could be a coincidence.
The European Space Agency, not NASA. Yeah.
Not NASA, sorry.
It could be a coincidence because red is high and blue is low. It's just the spectrum. It just so happened that because it could have been the other way and red could have been low. But that's a typical false color kind of algorithm to use. Maybe they tweaked it until it looked pretty, you know, not realizing that it looked pretty because the river looked like a river. I don't know. You're right. That would have been another level at which somebody in the PR office of the European Space Agency said, this could be misleading if we send this out to a scientifically illiterate public and call, you know, or maybe their headlines were more accurate, but they didn't count on the fact that this is going to be mistranslated a couple of steps down the media line.
At which point they should all lose their jobs if they didn't realize that this is going to be mistranslated and they work in PR.
Right. So yeah, there are a couple of levels of communication failure as well, I think, with this story. And Rebecca, you're going to finish up the news section with another story that again might has some similar theme to the last two.
No, this has got nothing to do with any of that. Nope. This is the story of a Daily Mail headline that read, "Wanted, adventurous woman to give birth to Neanderthal man."
Completely accurate.
What's wrong with that? That's
I'm not done.
That could have come from the journal Nature, as far as I'm concerned.
Why are they excluding men?
That was only the first half of the headline, the second half being Harvard professor seeks mother for cloned cave baby.
Oh, come on. I mean,
you got to hand it to the Mail, because few outlets can pack that many mistruths into one headline.
I think the cave baby needs a father, too.
So they write, the Daily Mail writes, "Professor George Church of Harvard Medical School believes he can reconstruct Neanderthal DNA. His ambitious plan requires a human volunteer willing to allow the DNA to be put into stem cells, then a human embryo. Professor Church's plan would begin by artificially creating Neanderthal DNA based on genetic code found in fossil remains. He would put this DNA into stem cells. These would be injected into cells from a human embryo in the early stages of life. It is thought that the stem cells would steer the development of the hybrid embryo on Neanderthal lines rather than human ones." So that's a bit from the Daily Mail. So this story actually began when Germany's paper of note, Der Spiegel.
Der Spiegel.
Jawohl.
Thank you. Published an interview with Church about his research. And English tabloids and bloggers picked up on a translation of the interview, and they just ran with it, which resulted in this explosion of excitement over the possibility of a Neanderthal baby and endless arguments over the ethics of cloning a person. Like, what about the 90% of clones that are malformed monsters? And what about the baby's freedom to grow up outside of a laboratory? And what about cloning more Neanderthals so that Neanderthal has friends? Or what if she's teased all her life? Or what if she inspires Pauly Shore to make Encino Man 2? Moral quandaries. But unfortunately, all of this speculation is based on just a bad translation. Church is not some Dr. Moreau character with plans to impregnate a woman with a Neanderthal baby. He told Der Spiegel that one day in the future, it's likely that the technology to clone a Neanderthal will be possible and that we may want to start thinking about the consequences of that now. And somehow that got translated into crazed professor seeks fertile human female to birth ancient being. In fact, Church has since pointed out that his work doesn't even involve Neanderthals in any way. He focuses on the use of genetics in healthcare and the development of synthetic fuels and other materials that will better our lives. One of his current research areas is developing the ability to edit human genomes, which is pretty awesome in and of itself. He doesn't really need all of this to do about a Neanderthal baby that never existed. In an interview with the Boston Herald recently, he said that he is not planning to run away from all this ridiculous publicity, though, and that he would use it as an educational moment to talk about journalism and technology, which is pretty cool of him.
That's good.
Because that's the sort of stuff, yeah, that we talk about on SGU all the time and all the time on this very episode. Good science that gets completely misinterpreted by an overeager, undereducated media and then passed along to the masses.
But it's a teaching moment. But my question is, when he says mistranslation, was this a mistranslation from English to German back to English? Or was this a mistranslation of a non-science journalist trying to understand what this guy's science is saying? Or is it a combination of both?
Language is what I picked up from his explanations of it. That it is English to German to English. Somewhere in there, that's where it went wrong.
But it also seems like, I mean, the Der Spiegel journalists did misunderstand what he was saying, because he was talking totally speculatively. Yeah, maybe someday we could even theoretically do this. Somebody, you know, not me, I'm not doing this research. Maybe he didn't make that clear. And they thought he was talking about research that he's actually involved with. It's like a telephone game, right? You know, there was several steps here before it finally got to the Daily Mail and looking for a surrogate mother for a Neanderthal baby.
Yeah, I think Der Spiegel is definitely going to have to take a lot of the blame for this. For
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
So I guess I don't get to throw bones in the yard with my Neanderthal son.
Not yet.
All right, Brian, you're going to give us more of a special report than a news report. You're just dying to unload your awesome knowledge about Nikola Tesla.
my lack of knowledge about Tesla. Yeah, the Skeptoid episode that I did last week was titled The Cult of Nikola Tesla. It's all about how conspiracy theorists in particular, but so many people have liked to deify Tesla, make him into so much more than he actually was. And, you know, of course, that's disrespectful to what he actually did and who he actually was, in addition to just being flat out wrong. And now I'd always known that this is something of a phenomenon, but I'd never really sat down to study it thoroughly until I did this episode. And it there was just so much in there that surprised me that I just wanted to share some of it with you guys tonight. What do you guys think of when you think of Nikola Tesla? What technology comes to mind?
Alternating
Tesla
current.
Alternating current. Yeah. And did he invent that?
Well, that's what I always thought.
Did a huge amount of the work.
Yeah. I always thought he invented it.
Yeah. He gets credit for it on the shows.
He developed it. I don't know if he.
Well, yeah. I mean, he did a huge amount of development on it.
Yeah. He has lots of patents for it. Right?
He invented it in the same way that Edison invented the light bulb.
There was actually guys who had test electrical grids distributing AC before Tesla was born. I had no idea that he was so not the inventor of alternating current, nor even the concept of distributing it that way. I didn't get to spend a lot of time digging into specifically how his particular patents worked and what was it exactly that was new about what he brought to AC. But there was obviously plenty in there substantial enough to get him all the patents and everything. And the other thing that I've known Tesla for was the induction motor, which the big breakthrough of the induction motor was that it lets you run a motor directly from AC without having to first convert it to DC at a loss. And then run it that way. So that was a big deal. But also, he was not even the first one to build an induction motor. There's this guy, Galileo Ferraris, who I presume is Italian.
I would think so.
Could be.
Who built one 2 years before Tesla did. And this was when Tesla was still a very young man, when he was still living in what was for a time Yugoslavia, before he came to the United States. So he had that idea in his head. Probably independently developed, but certainly not the inventor of the concept. And by the time he got to, the whole famous story of him working for Edison and they had the big fight over money and falling out and all this, and Edison was a jerk and all that. And all of that is probably fairly true as the urban legends say. But, he had this idea for the induction motor and for AC in his head, and George Westinghouse was actively looking for patents on those things. It wasn't like Tesla went to Westinghouse and said, here's this cool thing. Westinghouse already knew about him and was looking for someone who had these patents. So I'm not trying to belittle anything Tesla did, but I was amazed at how few of the urban legends about him are true.
Well, I think the broader concept here is that whenever you hear a story that this person or this group of people invented this technology, that's almost always a massively oversimplified version of events. That all these technological developments had antecedents, had competitors, had somebody who was working on a version of it, but somebody emerges as the person who just brings it to public consciousness, and then the history books boil that all down to he invented it. So We know that there were other people working on the airplane, you know, before the Wright brothers. There's even, I think it's Brazilians, right, who claim that they have precedence over the Wright brothers. There's other people who were, you know, working on the telephone and the phonograph and all these things, you know, the simple story of Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone. No, it's mm-hmm. that when the technology is ready, you have multiple people working on it. Ideas are being taken from different sources, you know, but there, it's the person who peeks through this sort of magic threshold first, they get all the credit. So I know I have read a lot about Nikola Tesla. He was, no doubt, he was a genius. I mean, he's an electrical engineer. He developed many things. He does have, I think, 700 patents to his name. What my understanding was is that he put all the pieces together in terms of developing, you know, the transformers and he made the technology feasible and put it all together so that you could actually have a system of distributing alternating current that would be practical for the country to adopt. That's what he did. And what Edison did was he had the direct current version of that, a system by which you could distribute direct current. AC was the superior technology and it won out. I think that much of the story is true.
The final thing that I had been most impressed about and had always wanted to know about was there was a popular movie. Was it what was the battle between the two magicians a couple of years ago? That movie, you know what I'm talking about?
The Prestige.
The Prestige.
Was it that where one of them went and visited Tesla and in Colorado Springs and he had all the light bulbs all laid out in the field and caused them to all magically turn on with no wires? But that's kind of a legend that we've all heard about how he had this big giant field of light bulbs sitting in the ground with no wires and he just caused them all to turn on. And that is apparently completely the fabrication of a biographer named John O'Neill. Tesla was talking about doing something like that. He did at least one experiment where he did something like this from about 10 feet away, but the light bulb was conventionally wired. It was the power that was being transmitted from one Tesla coil to another over a very short distance, and then the light bulbs all had to be conventionally wired to that. But this idea of doing it with 200 light bulbs from 26 miles away, there is no evidence that ever happened. In fact, there's pretty good evidence that it didn't.
All right, I think we have enough time for to get caught up on Who's That Noisy Evan. Do you really have to play the one from last week again, do you
Please
think?
Please don't play it.
Just
remind people.
All right, all right.
But it was horrible.
It's
turn your volume down.
Yeah, I'm taking off my headphones.
All right, last week's Who's That Noisy? Get ready. Here we go.
That was it?
It's done.
That was
it. You guys built up some big thing. I was all cringing in my seat here. That was nothing.
Well, if you heard it last week, it was almost piercing. You know, it's like chewing tinfoil. It's I think Jay described it, which is true. That is the sound of a knife running its edge along a bottle.
Why would you play that?
Of all things.
Why would you play that?
Why would I play that? Well, because there was a news item not too long ago that related to this. And I want to send thanks out to one of our listeners, listener John Kelly, who sent this along to our attention. Thank you, John. This came from Newcastle University back in October of 2012, and this press release is titled, Nasty Noises, Why Do We Recoil at Unpleasant Sounds?
Like when somebody says 2012. Ooh.
Gosh, what are they doing?
I said 2013 this week.
I'm proud of you.
Thank you. That was for you, Rebecca.
Yeah. Thank you.
So that's the most annoying sound in the world. Is that what you're telling us?
Yes. According to researchers, led by Dr.
Zoidberg?
Sukhbinder Kumar is his name, at Newcastle University. And he led a team of scientists who realized that heightened activity between the emotional and auditory parts of the brain explains why the sound of, for example, chalk on a blackboard or a knife on a bottle is so unpleasant. So it has to do with the interaction between the region of the brain that processes sound, which is the auditory cortex, and the amygdala, which is active in the processing of negative emotions when we hear unpleasant sounds.
So I mean, a sound being pleasant or unpleasant is purely a neurological phenomenon. There's nothing inherently, you know, annoying about that noise is that that's the way our brains interpret it.
Wasn't that bad? I've soiled my armor, and guys, it's nothing.
Ew.
Yes. All right, listener Sydney Wise. We selected your name at random of all the listeners who got it correct this week, and you are now in the final drawing for the end of the year.
I want to ask Sydney, what the heck is he doing around his house that he recognized that sound?
Well, a couple people remembered the article in particular that this referred to.
Right.
So well done, Sydney.
And Evan, you have a puzzle for this week, huh?
Yes, we came up with a good puzzle for this week. Here is this week's puzzle. I have two children. One is a boy born on a Tuesday. What is the probability I have two boys?
This is a classic statistics puzzle. That's very counterintuitive. That's all I'll say about it.
It is. Yes, we will. Go ahead and give us your answer. WTN at theskepticsguide.org is the official email for sending in your Who's That Noisy answers, or your puzzle answers in this case. Or you can post them on our forums at sguforums.com. Good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Evan. One quick correction or amplification from last week. Brian, do you know what a vomitorium is?
I have a son who is obsessed with random facts, and vomitorium has always been one of his favorite words. So I know two definitions. He has found that one of them is what you would suspect, a room where you're supposed to vomit in ancient Greece or wherever they enjoyed doing that sort of thing, college.
Rome, yeah.
And the other is the exits for a stadium.
Right.
That it vomits forth the people as they leave.
Apparently, it's just the exit.
That's right.
But they vomited a lot when they were walking out of the stadium.
So
must have been some bad shows going on in those arenas.
Last week, Rebecca, I believe it was you who threw out a casual reference to a vomitorium, and that, of course,
trying to zing the Romans.
Right. That unleashed our pedantic hordes, as they say, and they pointed out that the notion that there were special rooms for vomiting after meals or whatever is a complete myth. That no such thing in the history of Greece or Rome or whatever. However, there was the practice of vomiting, and sometimes voluntarily, sometimes as, you know, to extend the meal. So they did vomit. They just didn't have a room for it. They would go to the bathroom, you know, or they would just do it in a bucket.
Like a sensible person. Oh, what?
There are some people I know who should have a whole room dedicated for it.
Right. It's just a mistake that people made. The word vomitorium, and again, yeah, it's the same root to bring forth quickly, which refers to, for example, the many entrances and exits to the stadium, to the Colosseum, which could apparently 50,000 people could fill that place in 15 minutes. That's how efficient all the different entrances and exits were. And those were the vomitorium. So, over the
vomitoria,
thank you. Each one was a vomitorium. And over the years, certain scholars, conflated these two facts, the word vomitorium and the fact that Romans sometimes used to vomit voluntarily. And they made the incorrect assumption that the vomitorium must be where they did that, must be where they vomited. But it's just, you know, a trick of the Latin.
We're in good company, though. According to Wikipedia, Aldous Huxley may have been the first to use the misinterpretation in the book Antic Hay.
Or he was being sarcastic, maybe?
There strode in like a goth into the elegant marble vomitorium of Petronius Arbiter, haggard and disheveled person.
Existence of rooms dedicated to vomiting in the Roman Empire, ancient Rome, is a myth. We have two interviews coming up, so let's go on to them now. We are joined now by Lizzie Taylor. Lizzie, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
And Brian, you brought Lizzie to my attention. We're on the show to talk to the both of you in this segment about a recent project you've been working on. So why don't you just tell us about that?
Yeah, for a long time, I have wanted to get Skeptoid out to a Chinese audience. All other languages, obviously, would be great, but to do it properly, you have to really take it seriously, and you really have to have all your ducks in a row. There's a lot of back-end programming to get all the websites integrated and everything. There's everything needs to be transcribed. Everything needs to be all connected up. So what I did was I went out to find a Chinese-speaking host, And I got 5 test recordings from different Chinese speaking women who were able to transcribe and translate, and record the show. And I sent these to a focus group of people that I had in China that included a whole big group of students. And they overwhelmingly voted Lizzie's voice as the one that they most preferred. And just by great fortune, Lizzie happens to live very close to me. And she works in the translation industry, so she's got access to all sorts of resources for translating, you know, technical words, science words, weird things that we talk about on Skeptoid. So that's where we are. We're about 10 episodes into the show, and we are now live in China. And this is what Chinese listeners hear. Give them the intro, Lizzie.
您现在收听的是 Skeptoid. 我是丽丝。我们的网址是 skeptoid.com.cn.
Isn't that
awesome? That's funny, Brian. Because when I listen to your show, that's exactly what I hear. Blah, 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 Skeptoid, blah, blah, Skeptoid. That's uncanny. That's really fascinating. And Lizzie, so you're a professional translator. This is what you do for a living?
Yeah, it's my major. I was not a science major. I was a translation and interpretation major. So I am a freelance translator.
Did you have an interest in skepticism or science before Brian contacted you?
Actually, because, you know, I'm a girl, maybe I'm not, I was always like an art major, so, or linguistic major, and I wasn't science, I wasn't really into a lot of science. The only show I was watching is Big Bang Theory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good enough.
That's a good start.
But I got really interested once I started the project. Because all the topics, it's not like a dry, you know, hard to understand topics. They're like more to your daily life. And it's really interesting, I think.
So observing that women are more into art than science is kind of a loaded observation to make on this show for a lot of reasons. Is that, do you feel that in China that's the case, that girls or women in China are not encouraged to go into science? Is that perceived of as a male profession?
I think mostly when they choose their major for universities, they probably more tend to art or languages or history or politics. I think because maybe we are better than memorizing things, and we don't like to study the unknown. I think just in general, so.
Do you have any feeling for how the podcast is doing right now in China? How is it being received?
I only have sent it to my cousins, and they all love it. And because we only have 10 now, it's just starting, so I haven't really started to spread out and ask people's opinion.
I can tell you from looking at the numbers, what has happened is we started off with a huge peak, and it has fairly quickly tapered down to about 10% of what it peaked at. Now that sounds terrible. That sounds like, you know, oh, it was a novelty for a moment and then faded away. But looking at the listeners who are inside China, it has grown steadily. So that initial peak that we had was American people basically tuning in because, oh, the novelty of hearing a Chinese version of Skeptoid, probably mostly existing Skeptoid listeners. So the growth, when you look at just the raw numbers, doesn't look too impressive, but the country filtered is very exciting, I think.
There was this artificial peak of your curious listeners.
Yeah, but exactly. Yeah.
What about the censors or censorship that we hear about going on in China? How does Skeptoid work either through or around, or is it just like too low profile right now for them even to be taking notice at this point?
I think the topics we choose are like general scientific topics. They're not like sensitive like religious or politic topics. So I think we're fine.
Yeah, that's
so far.
One of the many challenges for doing this show is making sure which topics we choose are going to be ones that are not going to get us in any kind of trouble with the whole Great Firewall of China, but B, also interesting to the Chinese audience. And that's something that's been really surprising to me. A lot of the urban legends, things that are United States-centric or Europe-centric, are unheard of and uninteresting to some Chinese listeners. But anything that takes place in Australia, Russia, or anywhere in Asia, they're much more receptive to those, and they've heard of them more often. And of course, we've got the whole range of general, you know, food trends and things like that that are universal.
So they don't like hearing you making fun of stupid Americans?
I think that would be a great topic, actually, making fun of stupid Americans.
But isn't that like any American-centric mythology or urban legend? Wouldn't that sort of be the implicit, you know, thing?
Well, no, I'm talking about like the Amityville Horror was a great story for the American skeptoid because everyone knows that story, but nobody in China has ever heard of that.
So they just don't care.
They just don't care. Yeah. And we need to pick topics that are universal or, you know, of worldwide interest.
So, you're not doing every episode. You're handpicking episodes.
Oh, no. Yeah. I'm fortunate to be 300 and something episodes ahead on that so that I've got plenty to handpick from. So we're being very careful with that. Let me ask you a question, Leslie. Since you've got a few months experience with Skeptoid now and you kind of have a good idea of what it's about, what are some episodes, what are some subjects that you would suggest that you think the Chinese audience needs to hear? What kinds of superstitions do we have in China that we should do an episode about?
I think it's mainly about ghosts, like people afraid of death, of dead people. They show a lot of respect to dead people. So there's like all kinds of things, like what you should do if you... at night, you shouldn't look back and stuff like that. Because, we don't teach about God or ghost in class. So we don't really talk about it. It's all like from your grandparents or from your friends. So some people really believe in that.
How many people think that ghosts are real and might be something that would jump out and scare them?
I think a lot of my friends, they, you know, if they have relatives passed away, they sometimes expect to see them in the house, after the funeral, and something they can feel something, they can hear something during their sleep. So I think most people believe that the spirit or maybe the ghost.
That's great. Well, we'll throw some more of the existing ghost episodes of Skeptoid into your list.
Okay.
Now, Lizzie, if you want a real challenge, I have another project for you. You have to find 4 Chinese-speaking friends and then do you have to act out the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. You have to have one person be each of us.
Yeah, translate an hour and a half worth of material every week.
Yeah, right. And you got to get all the banter and all the jokes.
Conversational English.
Yeah.
Terrible jokes.
The inside humor. Yep.
You know, you guys, I mean, that's a really interesting point. I was singularly fortunate that my show format just happens to be something that can be readily translated and reproduced for a different audience. That was just luck. A show like yours, let's say hypothetically, was even an equally good or better show.
That's
my joke. Like you say, it's about your personalities, and it would be really hard. It would be really hard to translate that. So if we're looking at this giant overall project that we're all on the same team as, which is spreading critical thinking to as many people as possible, I think a project like this is one of the few that's available for reaching foreign countries.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it would be nigh impossible to do a translation of our podcast just because of the format. It'd be like dubbing a movie. I mean, it'd be that level of work.
Or the American version of Top Gear.
Yeah. Well, Lizzie, it's been really fascinating talking with you, and you know, keep up the good work. This is definitely spreading the word. And Brian, you too. I mean, this is, I think, a great idea, a great project.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Joining us now is Zach Coplin. Zach, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And Zach is a Louisiana resident. He's currently a history major at Rice University. But we're talking to Zach tonight because he has become a bit of an activist against the teaching of creationism in his home state and elsewhere. So, Zach, tell us how you got involved with this whole thing.
So back in 2008, I watched the summer before my sophomore year in high school as a creationism law, the Louisiana Science Education Act, made its way through the Louisiana legislature. And I didn't believe it was going to pass. It was 2008, and we finished the Scopes trial was in 1925, and I thought that was long over and done. But it wasn't. Yep. Despite that, I still assumed that my Brown University biology major governor, who's a Rhodes Scholar, would not sign this law. And so I watched in disbelief as not only did the law pass, but Governor Jindal actually signed it and has since defended and supported it. And so I'd always been really mad that this law happened and wanted to take it on. And by my senior year of high school, I realized no one else was taking it on. It had to be me.
So you had some hard life lessons there. So lesson number one, politics trumps science. Lesson number two, people don't give a crap. So now you're with us, right? So now you're at the point where we are. We're like, if someone's going to do something, right, who's going to do it?
So go into a podcast and gripe about it.
Right.
Could do that.
I hope that help. I hope it's more about go on the podcast and maybe advocate. That might help more. Maybe happier outlook.
That's what he meant. He meant advocate.
When I say gripe, I mean, you know, cheerfully, positively advocate.
Yes.
All right. Awesome.
So what did you do about this? You said, all right, something's got to be done. So what did you do?
So I assume most of the listeners and y'all know who Dr. Barbara Forrest is. And for anyone who doesn't know, she is she was a star witness at the Kitzmiller versus Dover trial, which invalidated intelligent design. And she also lives in Louisiana, is a professor, is right down the road from me. And so I sent her an email. I had a senior project in high school that I had to do to graduate, and I sent her an email asking, "Hey, I want to repeal this creationism law. I know you know. Like, I'd read her blog before, and I asked, will you help me repeal this law?" And she was all for it. We met and started working on the repeal.
And how did that go?
We built up a lot of support in our first year. We had about 43, 44 Nobel laureate scientists when we came into committee. We had the American Association for the Advancement of Science. We had the thousands of clergy members in the Clergy Letter Project. The city of New Orleans, their city council unanimously voted to urge the state to repeal this law. So we came in with incredible support, and we were voted down 5-1.
In committee?
In committee. One of the senators, Senator Julie Quinn, she's no longer one, but she was a senator on the Senate Education Committee at the time, explained she was tired of hearing from people with little letters behind their names, like the Nobel, like basically so these Nobel laureates. Yeah. Who are only people with little letters behind their names.
Yeah, what do those letters even mean? Nobody knows.
It's all
what are you hiding,
gook.
Scientists?
Well, Sir Harry Proto, that sir, he got knighted for, like, discovering the Buckyball, or, like any of these Nobel laureates who've done immeasurable things to basically set the foundation for the way we live right now. Yeah, they've done nothing, I guess. Just little letters. But she had two little letters that she made sure we knew. They were J and D.
Mm-hmm. So you've been trying to essentially repeal the Louisiana state law that allows teachers to introduce supplemental material in science classrooms, which essentially is a backdoor way of introducing creationist material. And what you found, and this is always the test, right? So we knew it was a bad law. We knew it was backdoor creationism, but we were waiting to see how bad it was going to be in implementation. And what you found out was that the science teachers were actually using this as an excuse not only to bring in creationist material, but to get rid of the standard science textbooks.
Yeah, so what happened when the summer that I wanted to repeal this law, I watched as in our local newspaper and on Barbara's website and on the National Center for Science Education's website, it reported that there was a school board meeting in Livingston Parish, where Barbara actually lived, where it wasn't just – because the law just allows teachers to bring in materials – the entire school board was discussing how they could not just bring materials, but actually use this law to make creationism a whole part of their curriculum. And they were talking about how this law is for, quote, critical thinking and creationism. And there's one quote, I forget exactly how it goes, but it was like, we don't want litigation, but why don't we need to take a stand for Jesus and risk it anyway. So it's just like, this came out and I realized this law is actually being used, and it's absolutely absurd. And so the other thing I wanted to mention, we sort of got into how this law worked. You said it's supplemental materials. These supplemental materials are specifically meant to, quote, critique things that are controversial, like evolution and climate change, specifically highlighted.
Right.
As controversial. They highlighted evolution, climate change. Like this one, the one I messed up on is like maybe it's like origin of the earth or origin of species, something like that. And then the last one is human cloning. And maybe we should mention that one for a little bit because since when is there – a scientific controversy at all, like, or even a political controversy over the science about human cloning. There's not a political controversy over that science. We can probably clone humans. There's an ethical controversy, but like.
Well, I'm thinking that's the point. It sounds to me like they just threw that in there to make it look like this is a list of debatable topics.
Exactly. And that's exactly what they did. But it's one of the ones where they didn't even know enough about how things worked to recognize it's not what they should have even thrown in.
I'd say it's probably not the only one on that list that they didn't know enough about.
So let's talk strategy for a minute. So, I mean, obviously repealing the law would be a good thing in a way, because it would at least take care of the problem for now in Louisiana. But the real progress that's been made in this battle has been getting the Supreme Court to declare such laws unconstitutional. And that requires somebody to challenge the law. Have you thought of working along those lines?
So the problem with a legal challenge is it's just – it's easier to go the repeal method actually, because we have – the way this law is set up, I mean, we have to have a plaintiff who has standing. We have to have a kid in high school comes out and challenges the law. First, they have to know their rights are being violated. Then they have to know how exactly they respond if they realize their rights are being violated. And finally, which is the highest bar of all, is they have to have the courage to do something about it.
Yeah.
The example I really give about this is – the kind of courage it would take is, I mean, for many people who know the story of Damon Fowler, which is he came out in a similar issue and found himself kicked out of his house, needed police security at his own high school graduation. A lot of these kids in Louisiana are going to look at this and say, we don't want – if we challenge this creationism law, our parents are going to throw us out of the house, and they don't want to do that. And so it's a really high bar to pass. That's one problem. The second is it's written in a very crafty way that makes this kind of accountability very, very tough. I can't go into I would love to go into a school and say, okay, I can look and see if they're teaching creationism. It's very hard for me to do that. And there's a lot of schools in the state.
Yeah. There was something else, though, that you did that was successful, and that was opposing getting rid of the standard science textbooks in the state.
And that was interesting. That was when I was just first getting started. It was in November where we first heard about this. And the local creationist group, the Louisiana Family Forum, who's an affiliate of Focus on the Family nationally, had apparently been sending in complaints about the science textbooks being too favorable to evolution all summer, and had gotten the State Board of Education to hold this meeting to reevaluate whether they were going to approve these textbooks. And so I had gotten in touch with Barbara. I'd gotten in touch with her group, the Louisiana Science Coalition, and I'd been sort of working with them, laying the groundwork for this repeal. And I got an email during school one day. It was Wednesday, and it said, hey, creationists are trying to throw out our science textbooks. Be at this meeting Friday to help stop them. And so it was like no warning. And what we found out is that not just was there no warning, but it appeared like we'd been set up. Two members of this committee on the textbooks were also the two sponsors of the Louisiana Science Education Act itself. It was looking pretty grim for us at that point. We expected that the entire board had been stacked and we would lose completely. Despite that, I showed up and dozens of other science advocates showed up. We testified, and it turns out the board was not stacked. We won 8-4 in that vote, in that meeting, and so we passed the first round. We eventually, over even more creationist objections, where one of my favorite stories is there was an old creationist retired judge who has been involved with a lot of this stuff in Louisiana and also in Texas. He went and testified before the State Board of Education. He pulled out a T-shirt with natural selection on this and basically said, this is the T-shirt that Dylan Klebo wore when he shot these kids, and that's why we
no.
can't have –
oh, my gosh.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was an incredible moment to even watch that happen. Despite his strong testimony about Columbine and natural selection, though, the textbooks got approved. And so we won that battle, and the creationists didn't like that very much. And so for the last 2 years, and quite possibly this year again, they tried an end run around our victory and tried to basically take away all authority from the State Board of Education to approve textbooks at all. And so it's this every inch we gain, we have to fight to hold it.
Zach, I'd like to ask you a job interview question. I'm wondering where you see yourself in 10 years.
I would hope I'm doing the exact same thing. I mean, my life plan, honestly, right now is just find a way to financially support the activism I want to do.
I can't think of a faster way to reach the dark ages than to try to destroy the teaching of science to our children. I don't say that lightly. I think that's absolutely true.
I mean, I think it literally is the way to reach the dark ages. I mean, we're in the dark ages where there wasn't really that much scientific advancement.
Exactly.
It's actually a knock against the dark ages, which weren't that bad. This is worse. All right, Zach, it was a pleasure talking with you. You know, thanks for all the work that you're doing. It's really encouraging to, you know, see a young man like yourself being so passionate about science and trying to debunk nonsense.
So much for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week?
Yes.
Yep.
Sure thing.
Okay. Actually, I misstated last week. So all of the regular rogues are at two-thirds or at 66% for the year. Brian, this is your first one this year, so you have a clean slate.
This is your chance to rock it to the lead.
Well, I can't append to my previous record of 1-0.
If you wish. No. But we do also keep annual statistics and overall, yeah. So that will count towards your overall score.
It's like a new season, Brian.
Yeah. All right, well, here we go. Item number one. Scientists have found functional quadruple helix DNA in humans. Item number two, in a 15-year follow-up study of laparoscopic gastric banding for obesity, the longest study to date, the procedure was found to produce no significant long-term weight loss. And item number three, a new analysis finds that, as a source of electricity, current photovoltaics are about 30 times more land use efficient than even the highest yield biofuel crops. Brian, why don't you go first for us this week?
Thank you for that. All right, I'll take them in reverse order here. And a new analysis finds that as a source of electricity, current photovoltaics are 30 times more land use efficient than the highest yield biofuel crops. More land use efficient. It seems plausible right off the bat, just because it doesn't take up a whole lot of space to have a set of solar panels. But if we're talking about the entire cycle, the mining that needs to go into it for finding the minerals and so forth used in the solar panel. Do we get to know if this includes that, or we probably get no hints and no help?
So by land use efficient, what I mean is the amount of electricity you can get out of 1 acre of photovoltaics, it would take you 30 acres of the most efficient biofuel crop to get the same amount of electricity. And yes, this includes absolutely everything from soup to nuts.
Okay. I'm perfectly satisfied with that. In fact, I'd even suspect 30 times more land use efficient is low. So I'm good with that one. Number two, in a 15-year follow-up study of laparoscopic gastric banding for obesity, found to produce no significant long-term weight loss. I do not buy that. This is not something that I've researched or looked into. I know a handful of people who have had this done for that time period or less, and they all definitely kept off tons of weight. So that one's difficult for me, but I don't have any data to go on. So that leaves us number one, functional quadruple helix DNA in humans. Functional. Functional meaning it's not just some cell that for whatever reason has mutated extra copies of DNA floating about in it.
It's doing something.
I think the DNA is going to do something if it's there. So I'm happy with that one. So I would say one is science, three is science, and two is fiction. I'm going for number two.
Okay, Rebecca?
Yeah, Brian made some really good points. I hate to base it on anecdote, but like Brian said, that's all I really have on the laparoscopic surgery thing. I know people who've had it. It's been very successful. It's not easy. It's very, very difficult. And it's not, you know, a ticket to, you know, perfect health. It's not, you know, an immediate giant weight loss and then you're like perfectly fit. Yeah. No significant long-term weight loss. Yeah. I think that's sounds really wrong to me. I'd be really surprised if that's true. This is good, Steve, because I haven't heard of any of these. So well done. I'm going to have to go with the laparoscopic thing just because I don't know much about quadruple helix DNA. That sounds wacky, but possible to me. Yeah, with current photovoltaics, biofuel crops are taking up so much room that I can believe that. So yeah, I'm going to go with the laparoscopic band.
You're going GWB.
GWB.
Good call.
Okay. All right. And Evan?
A quadruple helix DNA, a functional one. I wonder if that means they had found a non-functioning one prior, perhaps, and now they've recently either discovered that, well, wait, that actually is functioning, or they were looking at the non-functioning ones and said, let's look for some functional ones, and they may have found one. So I think that one's right. Photovoltaics, 30 times more land use efficient. I don't see what's wrong with that. Plausible, like Brian said, which leads me back to the laparoscopic gastric banding. Brian, you convinced Rebecca, at least to an extent. To more of an extent, you've convinced me, and I will go with you as well on this.
All right, so you guys are all in agreement. So I guess I could start with number one. Scientists have found functional quadruple helix DNA in humans. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yay.
This one's interesting.
Cool. So does that definitely mean there was non-functioning
that
one?
Caught my eye. No, it's the first time they've known about this. This is the first time they've proven that it exists in human cells. So, biochemists have been able to synthesize it themselves, and they've seen it in other types of cells, but now researchers publishing in Nature Chemistry have proven that it exists in human cells. This is so-called G quadruplex DNA. The G stands for guanine. These are strands of DNA that have a lot of guanine. And I guess that's the bit that's helping the four strands bind together. Most functional DNA is a double helix, the so-called Watson and Crick famous double helix of DNA. Two complementary strands that bind together. I guess two of those can themselves bind together, forming the quadruplex DNA. The researchers think that this may play a role in some cancers, and it may have to do with cell proliferation. And therefore, this could potentially be a therapeutic target if they could figure out precisely what role this is playing. So, interesting.
Is it a normal thing, or is it some kind of a mutation?
Do we all have it?
No, apparently different phases of the replication of DNA, it can form these quadruplex strands.
So in normal function, that's not an unhealthy thing? Okay.
Right. In normal function, but again, there's the question of, is this the point where things are going wrong in some cancers? And it's sort of triggering a out of control replication, because it is when the cells are replicating, when the DNA is replicating, that it seems to go through this phase, this quadruplex phase. But yeah, it's not an aberration. It's a part of the natural cycle of things. Yeah. Very interesting. Let's go to number two. In a 15-year follow-up study of laparoscopic gastric banding for obesity, the longest study to date, the procedure was found to produce no significant long-term weight loss. You guys all think this one is the fiction, and this one is the fiction.
Yay!
Very good, everyone. Good job, good job. But there was a 15-year study, and the longest to date. These were patients treated in Australia. That was just public. It's considered a landmark study that showed that it's quite effective. Your anecdotal experience is accurate, that people who get this done lose weight and they keep it off, because it's a sort of permanent anatomical change.
I'm always telling people to pay more attention to anecdotes.
Yeah, that's right. You've always said that.
Yeah, forget all that scientific evidence. Go with the anecdotes.
But despite the anecdotes, you still do have to study it scientifically, because otherwise you really don't know what role it's playing. But the science is supporting that. Yeah, it works. People have good outcomes. The more complications of obesity that you have, like diabetes, the more medical benefit there is to getting the procedure done. It's working. The procedure actually works.
And it seems like I've been trying to think all this time, like, what would it take for it to not work? Because, I mean, it's making your stomach smaller, so you can't consume the calories you would need to maintain, your current weight. And I think that the big downside to it generally is that it is health related, complications from the surgery, right?
Yeah, they can slip off. The lap bands are fairly easily removable, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. So this technology has been advancing quite a bit over the last 10, 15 years, actually. So it's getting safer, less invasive, while maintaining its effectiveness. It's actually a pretty reasonable option at this point. If you're of a certain size, you know, it's not worth it unless you're in a certain range of obesity. And interestingly, this may be changing, but if you get too big, then you're no longer a candidate just because the surgical risk becomes too high. You know, I guess the one possibility, Rebecca, is, well, how could it fail? You know, perhaps it would have been possible to stretch the stomach back out in other ways, you know. If you were pushing how much you could eat, maybe people could still manage to get in a lot of calories, even if it was, you know, spread out throughout the day.
Anecdotally,
yeah.
from what I hear from my friends, that is like a horribly painful thing. Like,
yeah,
you eat too many calories once and then you don't do it again because it's not easy. You know, I think some people think of it as like, oh, you know, it's a quick thing for weight loss.
No, you're right. It is tough.
Lipo or something.
But I
think if you wanted to stretch out that stomach again, it would take some serious dedication.
Yeah, right.
Electroshock therapy. Right. You go
pain
to reach
tolerance.
For the food. Zzz, give you a little shock.
But bottom line is it actually works pretty well.
Cool.
All of this means that a new analysis finds that as a source of electricity, current photovoltaics are about 30 times more land use efficient than even the highest yield biofuel crops is science. You guys sussed this out pretty well. Biofuel crops are fairly inefficient use of land. And the 30, it's actually 29 was the precise number. Mm. That's for the best biofuel crops we have. At the low end, like corn, it's more like 200 times more efficient. And this is for current photovoltaics, you know, which are getting better all the time. I mean, there's constant incremental improvements and with lots of interesting possibilities on the way for photovoltaics. So even now, you're better off filling that acre with
solar panels,
yeah, than trying to actually grow crops. And this was specifically as a source of electricity. What they were interested in was electric vehicles. If you're going to find a way to power all those electric cars that we're putting on the roads, how should we do it? Where should that energy come from? Should we grow more biofuels or should we hang more photovoltaics? So that's the question they were asking, not burning the ethanol directly in a gasoline car, right? In a combustion engine, but in an electric car. That's why I had to clarify as a source of electricity. And also, you can put photovoltaics anywhere. You don't have to put them on cropland. You know, you could put them obviously on land that is not being used or in cities or on your rooftop, you know.
And this particular study, this was just considering land use. It wasn't a dollar efficiency, right?
No, they actually looked at multiple outcomes, you know, but again, I can only cram so much into the sentence. So it's, photovoltaics are also more efficient in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. It's also cost effective. And it also used the least amount of fossil fuel at feeding into the system. So again, you asked Brian very, very correctly, is this considering the whole chain all the way up and down the line? And the answer is yes. So for both of these, you know, the fossil fuel gets expended as fertilizer, you know, tractors moving it around or in the production of photovoltaics, the mining of the minerals, et cetera, that photovoltaics use less fossil fuels except for the highest yield biofuels, like the switchgrass. Those are the only one that basically don't need any fossil fuel fertilizers. So that was the only one where, it was more efficient than the photovoltaics, but every other crop, the photovoltaics beat it out in that respect as well. So almost, I can't say all, but almost across the board, the photovoltaics were superior than the biofuel crops. All right. Well, good job, you guys. Very well done. Right. Brian,
you
kept your 100% awesome record. Absolutely.
Thanks for blazing the trail there, Brian.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. Evan, you're going to cover for Jay this week for the closing quote.
Yeah. I hope I do Jay some justice with this particular quote. So here we go. By doubting, we all come at truth. That's it. That's the whole
Very
quote.
Very good. Very yep. pithy.
Marcus Tullius Cicero.
You're supposed to say
anyone?
Kaikaro.
Kaikaro.
Kaikaro. Cicero was a Roman philosopher, a statesman, a lawyer, an orator, a political theorist, a consul, and a constitutionalist amongst many
Evan,
other
but,
things.
But was he a vomiteur?
Oh, most certainly. In all meanings and aspects of that particular
He vomited forth
word.
Philosophy. And,
of course.
And wisdom.
As he was walking out of the Colosseum.
Right. All right. Well, Brian, thanks for joining us this week. Thanks for covering for Bob and Jay.
Always fun. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, thanks for joining me again this week, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
And this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Do-do-do-do-do-do.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.